You're listening to Second Stories, created and produced by Second Story, with me, Abigail Brocker, as your host. Second Story is a nonprofit based in Northern Virginia, working to provide safe havens and opportunities to grow and thrive to youth in crisis and their families. We help at-risk and homeless youth step away from their first story, one often marked by abuse, hardship, and crisis, and write their own second story, full of hope and promise. Second Stories is the home for more stories like these from people in our community.
I was talking to my 14-year-old daughter last night, and she's like, "Oh, are you ready for tomorrow?" And I was like, "I am and I'm not." You know, I said, "Gosh, I don't know exactly what to expect, but also sometimes I feel like I've lost touch with that foster kid. Like, you forget these moments, and then something comes up, you know, something will probably happen this week that will absolutely remind me that it's a foster kid picked up that day on the street, you know, and it just, it leaves its battle wounds for sure."
My first impression of Tina Gordon is that she's peppy. She sings a lot at work, she told me, and she uses the word awesome for lots of things, her family and her life in general. She calls herself a lion and laughs about how her husband has to deal with the mama lion teaching her three little girls to be the same as her. This is Tina now, a professional, a mom, a wife, a peppy person. For years, though, Tina lived in foster care. She lived in an unsafe home, and she didn't always know when she would eat next. The long-term effects of this, she admits, will probably be with her forever. Tina grew up right here, in Arlington. She's a Northern Virginian through and through. The challenges of her childhood are truly in our own backyard. Today, she's telling us about what it was like to grow up as a foster kid, and later be adopted by a loving family, all while struggling with her self-worth, her relationship with her biological mom, and an overwhelming fear of rejection. She's a friend of Second Story, and her story is just as emotional as it is redemptive and inspiring. Tina, thanks for being willing to share your story with us today.
Hi, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure to be here today.
Tina describes her family as a matriarch family where women didn't have a lot of self-worth, which is sort of paradoxically interesting to me. Tina, can you talk a little bit more about that and what it was like to grow up in that kind of environment?
Yeah, the matriarchy with no power, in essence, you know, is something that I've come to think a lot of more in my adulthood than I did really then. But as I've looked back, I realized, you know, as my great-grandmother's husband left her, my grandmother's husband left the family. And then my mom, you know, had her first child at 16 and continued to have six more, you know, every couple years after that. And it just always seemed to be a search for love in all the wrong places. Well, maybe this one, you know, he'll stay because we're having a baby together. But five dads and six kids later, nobody stuck around.
So tell me more about what that was like growing up. You didn't have a dad. Your siblings were all from different fathers, too. What was your home like?
My home. Well, as you might imagine, with, you know, kind of low self-worth women who have felt a great deal of rejection in their own lives, some of them hurt very badly. You know, my mom went through some pretty horrendous events herself. You know, when you don't have that self-worth, you don't stick up for yourself. So she found herself on drugs and dating all the wrong people and just in trouble herself, and then had kids when she was still a kid. So it just continued. So when, by the time I came around, I was number four, and we ran the streets. You know, I remember when my youngest brother was less than, you know, 6 months old, we were all picked up on Lee Highway, you know, quite a ways from our house, and we were all just walking, you know. So there was no oversight, no concern as to where we were, because those women were all so busy trying to find themselves and find love themselves, find meaning in their own lives, that they really just didn't have time for us. Lots of free reign, lots of police in our childhood.
Yeah. So did it feel normal to you to have that kind of childhood, or did you see your peers and your friends and say, this is weird? Like, why aren't we like that?
That's a good question. I mean, I think the obvious differences really were that we didn't have food and water often in the home. And so I often knocked on classmates' doors around dinner time. So, you know, it was absolutely by design. I wanted to eat that day, and we didn't have food in the house again.
Right.
There were definitely more than one, you know, moment where I could remember kind of just sitting there in a quiet place thinking, this isn't right. This isn't right. This feels so wrong to me, but not knowing how to find help or to talk to somebody and really understand that other people didn't live the way that we were.
How was your relationship to your mom?
My mom, I loved my mom so much, and she loved me. She loved all of us, really, with everything that she had to love. And which sounds odd too, you know, now we'll get into the fact that, you know, social services came in and Department of Family Services came in and took us all away. And so why would they take kids out of a loving home? You know, even though she didn't have her act completely together and she was making really bad choices for herself and for us, she loved us. You know, there was just never a day in my life that I could tell you I felt unwanted or unloved. Mm-hmm. And that meant a lot. You know, even though my mom gave me a lot to then deal with and go to therapy for, you know, down the road, she also gave me the first tool in my toolbox to survive with.
So you were taken away from her. Do you remember how you felt in that moment? It sounds like you were out of your home. They found you sitting on the street.
Yeah, so my mom had friends, I think, in the social services office. And somebody had called and tipped her off that police and social workers were coming to the school to remove us and put us into foster care. So she preempted that and went pretty soon after we had arrived to school and told us all. I mean, and it was a frantic moment. It was, let's go. She was screaming. The whole office, I think they knew also what was going on. And she was just screaming. It was chaotic. I mean, it was like some awful movie scene, you know, but it was our life. And she's like, I want my kids. Go get my kids. Go get your brother. Go get your sister. Go get, you know. And just like barking orders at us. And my older brothers they're like running around collecting all of us. And let's go, let's go. And we're escaping the school and, you know, running as far away as possible until she felt that we were safe. And we started kind of walking through some back roads home. And we just like, I mean, to a different kind of movie scene. And every access road out was now blocked.
Oh my gosh.
With police and social workers' cars, you know, and just literally surrounding us, getting out of the cars, and my mom saying, run, run, you know. And
it was like a movie.
Yeah, it was intense.
So you must have felt really betrayed when social services came.
Yeah, if the audience could see my face right now, that's a...
She looks like she's having a real moment.
Deep breath.
I can let you in on that.
Yes. Oh, yeah. There were so, so many years of betrayal that I felt from...
Against her or against the system?
Both, really. I mean, I didn't... Less against Department of Family Services because I really hadn't had a lot of interaction with them. You know, nobody came up to me on the street asking me about, you know, what my family was doing. And then for sure, my mom, I felt bad for her because I thought she was a victim just like we were, right? So I sided with her. And so the betrayal there didn't come you know, till a few years later as we're entering more the adoption phase. And she's signing papers to never see us again. And certainly later, you know, when I had my first child, funny enough, as a single mother, and it just slapped me in the face, you know, just all of those decisions that she also must have been confronting and made very, very different decisions than I did. That was probably the largest point of betrayal, you know, that I felt. That I felt that beyond betrayal, she was just a liar. How could she tell me all those years that she was doing everything that she could to get us back, and that she loved me and she wanted to be with me, yet every decision she made put me further and further away from her.
All growing up, you're trying to keep yourself safe from what you think is the enemy, social services. And then you actually enter into a foster home and you feel betrayed by the system, by your mom, whatever. What was that like?
I mean, hurtful. Hurtful. And that every day hurt. I was in a new family. I was, you know, missing my my biological family and, you know, not knowing yet just how unhealthy it was. It's all they knew, all that I knew, you know, that house, that street, that school, my mom, my brothers, my sisters, my aunts, my uncles, you know, it hurt not to be there. I mean, I just longed every minute of every awake moment to be back with them. And it changed as I moved forward, you know, in different homes in the foster care system. So I was in the system for 5 years, and the first home was only for 6 months. And it was almost, you know, after having been completely neglected in your original home, not completely knowing that, then I'm where you go to this other home who they've never taken in older kids. And my sister and I were 5 and 7, really close to being 6 and 8. And they have no idea what to do with us. You know, as I stated earlier, we didn't have food and water and things in our home. So we stole food. We would hoard it, you know, stuff it under our mattress thinking that tomorrow there might not be a meal. And they had a really hard time dealing with that. And we'd hear them daily on the phone with social services asking for us desperately to be removed. And they just couldn't handle our needs. And, you know, the fighting, and I mean, my sister and I fought like cats and dogs. In hindsight, I mean, my today self might go in and say, so I can't fault them for wanting to get rid of us so desperately, given the fact they had a choice. But as a little kid, it hurt, and it didn't incentivize us to be any better. You know, and all those, we had weekly visitations at that point, and our mom just chalking our heads full of promises and hope and don't love them, they don't love you, and it's all, you know, the system against our family. Don't let it happen. And so we did get moved. And, you know, after our school year finished, we moved in back into Arlington, actually, very close to where we had grown up with our biological family. And that mom was definitely more equipped to kind of handle us. And yeah, and we were happy there, and we wound up being there for 3 years, which is much longer than you're supposed to be in temporary care. Right. But we were happy. You know, we didn't have to figure out a new home, new parents, new family, new friends, new school, you know, all that stuff. Because you certainly wind up entering a phase where you just want to be accepted. You know, you might not want to be there forever, but you also don't want to get tossed back to the pool and then have to go to another home. Mm-hmm. So we were students, you know, good students, I'd say, of, you know, family life and expectations and rules, and we're sure to follow those to a T so that we wouldn't get thrown back and rejected again.
Right. And you did end up going to one more placement, right?
We went to one more placement, and that was hard.
Is that the hardest transition?
In foster care, for sure. It definitely rivaled being taken away from our mom. But they really were the right family. And, you know, I've talked to my adoptive mom now about that and how I don't think that I would have survived as well without her being my mom. Like, she was absolutely meant to be my mom, mm-hmm. be the one that raised me and gave me my, you know, my wings in life. Mm-hmm. And because for as little patience and perhaps training that first foster family had, my mom Beth, it had it in spades. Patience, understanding, you know, love, everything that you could want, and just, and the right amount of pushing you off the net, out of the nest, right, without making you feel unsupported. Talk about a life tool, you know, to just learn early and in kind ways that somebody was there for you but wasn't going to be your crutch. It was pretty powerful.
Yeah, this combination I'm hearing of, I know you can do it, like, don't pretend like you can't do it, but also, if you have trouble, I'm going to be here for you. You're not going to fail on your own. There's going to be someone waiting. I feel like that's this incredible combination, and a lot of the time when we see kids, when I see kids that have struggled, they don't have one or the other. You know, someone's either said, you're not capable of doing X, Y, and Z. Like, you're just fated to be where we are, or you run off and do whatever you want, but you have no one waiting for you if you fail. But to have that combination that you had, that is what really made a difference for you.
It was huge. Mm-hmm. Not just in her role of support and, you know, kind of pushing me to push myself, you know, push the limits and really discover who I was meant to be. But I'm probably going to completely break down and cry. As I'm just thinking, I'm like trying to like muster the strength to not break down. But the most powerful thing that my mom gave me, my mom Beth, was in those first days and months and even years. I mean, I was awful. Don't let me convince him otherwise. I was punching my dad. I was, you know, almost on a daily basis, I was getting in a physical fight with him. You know, I didn't know how to deal with men, honestly, except in really tumultuous kind of situations.
Right.
And so he bore a lot of the brunt of my anger. But my mom didn't escape that either. And it could be a simple task of, you know, hey, it was your day to do dishes. You didn't do dishes, so you just earned yourself a week. What? And oh, you adopted us because you wanted slaves. You just wanted slave labor and, you know, people to do all your work that you don't want to do because you're rich, elitist. And I'd scream these hateful things at her and call her lots of names I won't put on your podcast. And in the midst of this just extremely hateful, hateful moment that I would have, I mean, every wrongdoing made against me was coming out and lashed at her, who didn't deserve it, oh, by the way. She just looked at me and told me I was beautiful. Tina, you're such a beautiful person. I think there's even more inside of you than I've discovered. And I don't know why you're acting so ugly right now, because I know it's not who you're meant to be. But go to your room and think about the beautiful person you're meant to be. And, you know, as a mother now, I think she needed me to go to my room so she could then collect herself and process all these hateful things that I had just spit at her. But it also was like an amazing time for me too, because those were the first moments that I had slowed down, that I was forced to just be with myself inside my own head and really thinking hard about who I wanted to be, who I was meant to be, and thinking, wow, this beautiful, I mean, beautiful, she's in her 70s, she's still gorgeous. But this beautiful, wicked, smart, wonderful woman just told me I'm beautiful. Nobody had ever told me I was beautiful. And that was amazing. And I remember, you know, the left shoulder, right shoulder, Tina fighting with each other, going, well, she must be crazy. You know, there's no way. I'm awful. I'm a hideous person. Hideous things have happened to me. I must be hideous. She must be crazy. What is she seeing? And then the other shoulder going, but remember how beautiful and smart she is? And huh, she's never spent a day at the shrink's office till you came. maybe she's onto something. And I would go through this every time. And there were lots of times, you know, lots of opportunities she had to tell me I was beautiful. And she didn't understand why I was acting so ugly. Go to your room. And just those three simple phrases made me think. And it was really the starting point to me believing in myself. And maybe, just maybe, I was worth more than I had endured and been subject to earlier in life. It didn't come right away. Without her telling me I was beautiful, though, I wouldn't have even tried to fake it till I made it. And I wouldn't have ever gotten there. And probably would have found myself in many more dangerous, you know, kind of decisions and stuff. But I wanted to come home. I wanted to talk to her more. I wanted to discover this beautiful person that she kept talking about.
Tina, it gets me so much when you say that. That's so powerful. And the fact that you can look back on that moment in your life as making that much of a difference for you is so beautiful. You have a great relationship with your adoptive mom now, but you've also reconciled with your biological mom. What did that look like?
We wound up really having a relationship almost my entire life. When we moved into the Baths, all visitations and communication was cut off. So that was 12 and a half, maybe that happened. But as soon as I turned 16, I remembered my way back, quote unquote, home, and just knocked on the door. And we just both broke down, you know, crying like these kindred spirits that had been separated against our wills. And now we're reuniting. And I needed to hear her story too, which over the years I did, you know, eventually get that, which allowed me to have a lot of compassion and forgiveness, you know, for her, for what had happened, for us being removed. But as, you know, as I became a mother, it became harder and harder to forgive her. It was really, I was an adult. I mean, I wasn't a 16-year-old single mom. I was a 29, you know, almost 30-year-old having a child. And it was hard. It was hard, that forgiveness. And I remember being really angry with her. But no matter how much I tried to push her away and say that, you know, we didn't understand each other, it wasn't true. And so ultimately, you know, she got very ill and I invited her into my home and she lived with me until the end.
Well, and what a beautiful sort of redemption that she couldn't take care of you and someone else had to take care of you instead. And then at the end of her life, you were able to take care of her in the way you wished she could have done for you. I mean, that's a beautiful way to end that mortal relationship.
Right. Which was not easy all the time.
Yeah.
Talk about memories.
Yeah.
I just started keeping a journal to keep my sanity and to just get things out. They were coming so fast.
Yeah.
I didn't know what to do with them. So I just wrote them down for another day. But it ultimately, it was just important to me to have that relationship, to have that bond and not desert her. I didn't feel that she deserved the same even though I had gotten it.
Right.
And that's sort of the beautiful thing about truly putting something in your past, right? Not forgetting about it, not locking it away, but facing it head on, tackling it, tackling all the demons and putting them in their rightful places. We've talked some about like what got me there, right? I've touched on seeing therapists.
Right.
I've definitely, involuntarily, involuntarily, you know, seeing therapists. And my biological mom's undying love for me as, you know, a tool that, you know, I could draw on. My adoptive mom's, you know, just unwavering support and belief in me that I was going to become something great. Or just functioning.
It's important too.
Not a menace to society.
Yeah.
But, you know, that, but all of those were, you know, wound up being tools that I could leverage, not just then, not just when my mom was telling me I'm beautiful, not when my mom was telling me she loved me, not, you know, even when I'm at church and I feel God's presence. It's every day I can use those tools and say, I know I'm not supposed to still be on that track.
Now you have a good job, you have three kids, you're married. You talk about the cycle of men deserting their families and women having low self-worth, and you've broken the cycle for sure. You live a very different life than the one that you grew up in. What has that been like?
Awesome.
Like, what's so awesome about your family and your life now?
I'm laughing because, you know, like, I'm such a stereotypical Northern Virginia mom. I'm really competitive. My kid is, like, the best at everything. I coach because I didn't trust the other coaches to, you know, do a good job.
I have to do it instead.
Yeah. And so my, you know, my oldest is 14. And so I've had those years with her, you know, to coach her and mold her, hopefully in a good way. I don't know. And she turned out pretty well so far. So I think I'm on a good path. And my youngest two are three. Three and a half, mm-hmm. as one of them will tell you very clearly. Mm-hmm. Three and a half, just not just three.
Yeah.
And they're awesome. And my husband's awesome. You know, like we don't have a perfect marriage by any stretch. You know, who does? Nobody. It's so completely different, you know, than my own upbringing. And I'd say the only thing that is the same is that I've taught all of my children to love the way that my biological mom taught me to love. I think it's important to share that even though, you know, you started like, hey, you turned out, you made it, and now you're on the other side and I'm on a different track, but it doesn't, like, my past didn't disappear.
Yeah.
And, you know, for the audience or, you know, the kids that you work with,
yeah.
I think that's such an important message that, you know, life isn't a bouquet of roses, you know, once you leave,
yeah.
right? There's still going to be so many dark days or dark moments that you have to get through.
Mm-hmm.
But owning them. Owning them and understanding, you know, what's in your control and what's not, you know, and making decisions. You have to forgive, right? Forgiveness is huge.
Mm-hmm.
I touched earlier a little bit on, you know, my faith.
Yeah.
And I learned that, you know, forgiveness, truly how to forgive through my faith.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't really touch actually on my faith a whole lot earlier and how that developed. Like, trust me, nobody was thinking about God and I'm at that house in Arlington, but there was a retirement high rise right across the street from us. And Miss Morgan lived in that high rise. And I don't know how it happened, but she took my sister and I under her wing and made sure we got to church every Sunday. And then as we got older and, you know, we joined Pioneer Girls, which is like a youth group, really fun, you know, kind of group where you sing and go camping and do all these awesome things that girls want to do. And interestingly, my husband doesn't have faith. And he asked me why it's so important to send our children, you know, put them through Sunday school and for me to go. I learned how to treat other people and be kind and forgive. And what was truly right and wrong is not a point that should be forgotten.
Yeah,
and
very formative.
Very, very formative for me.
Okay, yeah. Last question. If you could look back at your life and say, if it weren't for this one thing or these two things, I don't think I'd be where I am now, what would that be?
Social services intervention. My biological mom, my adoptive mom, gets the lion's share, you know, of the credit. Therapists, you know, that we were forced to see through foster care, and God.
Tina, thank you so much for being with us. This has been so wonderful. I feel like I'm there with you, and I feel like I'm there in those moments where you are encouraged and when things made a difference for you. And thanks for being in our community and for caring about Second Story and caring about kids. It means a lot to us.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Second Stories. If you enjoyed this episode, we would be so thankful if you rated our podcast and left us a review. Be sure to also hit subscribe so you don't miss our next episode. Second Stories is created and produced by Second Story with production support from Franklin Vaughn. Second Story is a nonprofit based in Northern Virginia that works to provide safe havens and opportunities to grow and thrive to youth in crisis and their families. Learn more about what Second Story does and how you can support us at second-story.org. That's second-story.org. We hope you'll join us next time.